Hey guys, nice to see you again. Do you want to talk about things? I like things, and one of my favourite things is forking and forks and hard ones. Soft ones, hard ones, all kinds of forks
and
are
spoons.
Good for me. Let's talk fork.
Okay. Just to start off, I'm Anna.
I'm Frederick.
And for the purposes of this podcast, I'm Jeff.
Today we're going to be talking about the hard fork in Ethereum that happened earlier this week. Most of the people listening may know what a hard fork is, but if they don't, I'm going to give a little definition. A hard fork is a significant change applied to a blockchain protocol, and it requires that all nodes and users upgrade to the latest version of that protocol software. The hard fork is a pretty extreme change in a protocol, and it is something that it's happened 5 times in Ethereum's history, so obviously this is a pretty major deal to have it happen this week. And this is something that we'd like to talk about, kind of explore some of the reasons for this, the lead up to it, maybe look a little bit at some of the issues with this rollout, and take a little look at what could be coming up in the future.
So I think maybe a bit more of a layman's explanation of a hard fork is that a blockchain is a series of discrete blocks. It's not like a continuous thing. It's broken up into chunks. And at a hard fork, everyone decides to change the rules as of a certain block number. So, you know, between 1 and number 4, it has some set of rules. And then everyone decides that at number 5, they will all change the rules. And it's important that everyone has to decide, because otherwise the ones that don't change will say, well, these don't fit the rules, so we have to get rid of these. And the ones that have changed say, well, these don't fit the new rules if they're still on the old rule set, and so we have to get rid of these. And this is why it's called a fork, because the two groups on different rule sets will then end up diverging, because they will not respect each other's blocks.
I think that's a pretty good explanation. And I just want to go on the record of saying that I think the term hard fork is a very bad term. Like, I think it's terrible because it doesn't actually say much of what's going on. It's become a very contentious term. And it sort of instills panic, because people think that this means, like, a hard fork automatically means that there will now be two coins. So in the case of Ethereum Classic, we had a hard fork that was actually not at all related to a protocol upgrade. It was someone saying that, hey, we should actually, like, it's still, in Jeff's terms, we're changing the rules. So the rules that was changed in that case was, one group wanted to allow the DAO hacker to get away with the funds he'd acquired, and the other group didn't want that. So that was the change in the rules. So I think change in rules is a really good term to say, you know, why a hard fork happens. But a better term than hard fork, I think, is like a protocol upgrade versus a network split. Because there's a lot of hard forks where the intention is to split the network. Like, that's what they want to do.
So, yeah, this is the thing. It only, in a hard fork, a fork only actually happens if there are some people who want to continue on the old rule set. If there are no remaining clients on the old rule set, then, you know,
it's
if a tree
forked.
Falls in a forest, does it make a sound? Like, if everyone moves to the new rule set, has it forked, or has it just, you know, changed direction?
I think that actually, Frederick, you make a really good point, that right now the same terminology is used for both of those things. I think it definitely created a lot of anxiety for people. People were very concerned, even with this fork, that it would split off again, that there would somehow be another token created. But it's been made very clear that that is not necessarily the outcome of a hard fork. Maybe we can talk a little bit about why this was happening at all. Like, about Metropolis, about the planned Ethereum development, what's coming up.
Right. What went into this hard fork, essentially?
Yeah, so there are a few things that are part of this, and they're all specifically protocol-level upgrades. So one thing about Ethereum and pretty much every blockchain system that exists out there is that most of the functionality is baked into the actual implementations of the clients and baked into consensus. So you can't really all a fork is when you change the consensus. But with Ethereum, with a lot of these other ones, you can't just change these non-consensus related stuff without also changing consensus because everything's intertwined. So you'll notice that like none of these really necessarily require that people stop accepting the old blocks, but there's not really any way to do these upgrades without the old clients from discarding any changed blocks. So the first one, something that's pretty important to people who like failure, is the revert opcode, which is basically so at the moment, if you want to if something goes wrong and you want to in a contract, if you you go to your bank and you try and withdraw money and then they find out that the account has no funds left in it. I mean, obviously you could check in advance, but say that you're doing something a bit more complex and you're sort of checking as you go and you want to say, ah, something's gone wrong, let's end this now. Probably not that dramatic. The only way to do that at the moment is to just pick some random point in memory, pretend it's a function, jump to that, and then have the client say, hey, that's not a function, and then blow up, which consumes all the gas. So basically any money that you paid for that transaction just disappears off the face of the earth, and is generally just a bit of a dramatic way to revert a transaction. So this is a new opcode, and I explained exactly why it's new rather than just changing the rules on how the old one worked. It's a new opcode that does this thing of reverting the state and goes back to where it was before the transaction, but doesn't use up all your money or your gas.
So this is, I think, something that's familiar to any programmer as, you know, an early return, where for some reason in your program, you're saying you're not abiding by the rules, or like you said, if someone wants to withdraw money and there's, you know, an agency that has blocked this person from withdrawing money, you can now return early. So it's really an early return that doesn't consume, like it just says, okay, we're done here. We're not going to spend any more gas and stop.
Well, we have early returns already. An important difference is that with exceptions, either with the shout and shit pants style that we used to have and with the revert opcode, both of them, they also revert any changes that you've done during that transaction. So if you've, added some stuff to a database, if you've given some money to someone else already, that stuff will be undone in both cases. And so this is a new thing, rather than just allowing the shout and shit pants exception to not consume all the gas. The reason that had to be new is because it's entirely possible that there are contracts out there that check the amount of gas used to find out whether or not the virtual machine has exploded, which is something that you should definitely never do, but you're allowed to do it, so people do it. This is the PHP method of backwards compatibility. we allow them to do it, and people stab themselves on their own sword, and now we can't take the sword out in case they start bleeding out.
Yes, so the next Ethereum improvement proposal on our list to cover here is transaction receipts, including a status field. So this is sort of related to the revert opcode. Like you said, there are people who check that if all gas in a transaction has been consumed, they might or might not count it as a failed transaction because it was out of gas. That's obviously not a reliable way to do things. And when we have the revert opcode, we can actually fail a transaction without consuming all the gas. So now we absolutely need a way to say, was this transaction successful or not? So this status is now included in the transaction receipts that are included in every block. And this is important for several reasons. Most importantly, in my opinion, is that light clients can now easily see if a transaction was successful or not.
So Delight clients, I actually legitimately don't know this. At the moment, do Light clients get that information? Do they have enough information to know whether a transaction has failed?
Like, no, not okay. That I'm aware of.
I guess they don't get much, but they do get the transaction receipts. So that's cool.
Yeah.
I don't think there's much more to that. That one's a pretty small one.
Yeah.
Hey, you can have the next one as well. I'll give you this.
There's actually two more that are sort of related here and often covered together, and that is the addition of elliptic curve operations. One is integer modular exponentiation, and the other is curve addition and scalar multiplication for a specific elliptic curve. So these are both cryptography-related things. One specifically for elliptic curve cryptography, and the other more like you can almost do no cryptography at all without doing integer modular exponentiation. So you kind of need these things to do more advanced cryptography. The reason that these are being added and not just implemented in contract code is that doing these things in Solidity is extremely expensive. Basically, doing elliptic curve pair checking, for instance, is entirely possible to do in Solidity, but it would cost so much gas that it couldn't fit in a single block. So the reason they're being added is that it's very possible to create very efficient implementations of these things on the client side. So by making them a built-in contract, it's significantly cheaper to do these operations. And these implementations can be, highly optimized, implemented in assembly or whatever any client wants to implement them in and make them very efficient. And so we now have these cryptography basics in place that are now relatively cheap to actually perform.
Yeah, exactly. I think it would be also nice maybe if we could just make the EVM faster, but that also requires a lot of redoing this work on clients, whereas if you do it as a contract call, I'm pretty sure that gets then stored in the chain. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's essentially a some kind of form of memoization so that not everyone has to recalculate the entire contract, which is all fun.
Well, what do you mean by stored in the chain?
Ah, right. Okay. So if you have some operation that you want to do, you have to have each of the EVM bytecode bits. You have to store the entire code of what's happening in sort of one transaction address, whatever. You have to store all of it in one go, and then when someone else wants to validate that this has been executed correctly, they have to re-execute this themselves. But if you have this, as these are implemented as on another contract, so you will call out to this, you will get the result, and then that result will be stored as like an intermediate result of the calculation, unless I'm totally talking out of my ass. Fred, you.
It's a built-in contract. So if you make a call to it, you could, with the next thing we'll talk about, you could make a static call to it, and then just have the result available in your contract. Then it's up to you whether or not you store that, as the result of your execution, or you could call the built-in, throw away the result, and it wouldn't be stored anywhere.
Okay, that's fair. I thought that it was that all calls were stored, even ones that were sort of executed by contracts. I think I'm just wrong. It's fine. Being wrong is okay. I'm glad to be corrected. At the moment, when you call someone else, you have to say how many bytes you're expecting, which is fine for stuff like numbers, because you know exactly how many bytes a number is going to be, but is rubbish for arrays. I mean, at the moment you just store a pointer somewhere and then you return a pointer, but then that means that you don't end up with much genericism. So if you are delegating calls to someone else, so you take someone's you take a request for a call and then you pass that on to another contract, you basically have to redo that work for every single different call that there could be, because you then have to recalculate the length of the return. So now there is just one call where you say how many bytes is the length of this return, and then you can just accept that many bytes. You don't have to calculate it in advance, which is a real nicety. I'm not sure actually. Does it make anything faster, or is it just straight up ergonomics and expressivity kind of stuff?
I'd say it's ergonomics and expressivity. Expressiveness, expressivity. And I'm not
sure. Oh, yeah. Okay.
I don't think it makes anything faster per se, but it's been a pain in the ass to try to do this before. And now it's easy. So yeah.
Yeah.
Covered static?
Sorry?
Did you cover static already?
No, we haven't. Well, we mentioned it.
Briefly.
Mentioned it in passing. Static That's called call. Foreshadowing. Yeah? That's writing 101. So this static call basically is a call. You can call a function. I don't know if I have time to explain this if you don't know what calling a function is, but you can call a function in a way that basically enforces that nothing can be changed as a result of this function.
It's a pure function.
It is a pure function. Yeah, this the Haskell guy is made very happy by this.
We have almost Haskell on the EVM.
people have tried to make Haskell on the EVM before, right?
Well, I don't know about Haskell, but I have seen an EVM backend to Idris, except it didn't work. Like, it was so ridiculously slow that you, like, basically adding two numbers would fill up a block. So it was just not very good.
Well, WASM contracts will fix everything,
yes.
Right? Yeah, of course. Once we've got WASM contracts, nothing will be a problem in the EVM ever again. That's not true. And now, I think these are a bit more of contentious issues, mm-hmm. Contentious changes. Sounds well, I think like the uncles one is probably fine. Basically, Ethereum rewards you even if you were not the winner. It has like the blockchain participation trophy.
So to clarify, you said if you're not the winner, you still get paid. If you're not the winner in the proof of work lottery. So in proof of work, you have to produce a block within a certain amount of time. If two people produce a block at the same time, one can only get accepted, but both are valid. So the one that didn't get accepted but is still valid still gets some reward.
Yeah, and these are called uncles. And then there's delaying the Ice Age, which basically means that Ethereum will actually continue to work instead of now, where like the times for transactions are getting longer and longer and longer. This was supposed to be on purpose so that there would be like an impetus for implementing proof of stake, but then everyone decided that proof of stake was hard and they didn't want to do it, and so they did these other things instead. They just changed a number, which is much easier, and then they did another thing, which is just changing a number.
One of the larger and most contentious of all is the reduction of the block reward from 5 to 3 Ether, and I'm very curious to hear if either of you have heard feedback about this.
Well, I think people who already hold a lot of Ether are probably happy, because this means that their Ether gains value faster.
Well, yeah. I haven't really seen any direct feedback after the hard fork, but there was a lot of feedback before the hard fork. So, like you said, it's definitely one of the most contentious EIPs out there, and like if you go to GitHub and look at the pull request for it, the discussion is miles long. At some point, it was actually right after the hard fork, someone wrote, int03h wrote, painful births are always the most rewarding. Thanks for your work on this.
Okay,
and
that's graphic.
And the discussion has just kept going since then.
So
the thing is, you said, there's one aspect in which we're now saying the inflation is less, and so theoretically it should be worth more. but the difference is so subtle, and it's very hard to argue that the value of cryptocurrencies right now is based on nice, clean, theoretical economics.
Right. Yeah.
So whether or not the reduction in rewards will actually increase the value of the coin, maybe long term, but we'll have proof of stake long before that kicks in, I think.
That's very optimistic of you. surely the ETH per second, if you want to phrase it like that, has increased though, because the block time has gone down by more than 50%, right. I believe.
So that's where the whole argument sort of starts coming up to something that's hard to pinpoint, like whether one side is right or wrong. Because like you're saying, the ETH per second miner reward has increased, actually. But that's only because like the Ice Age difficulty bomb had started kicking in, and the like block times were getting really long, and now we're delaying that. And so by kicking in this, you know, reduction in reward and, you know, having the block time again, we're back to what it was, but we're actually below what it was if we look a year ago.
Right.
I have a question. Why? So it's being touted as like the first step in the process of moving from proof of work to proof of stake. But why is that? Why is this lowering of the fee part of that step?
Because we're weaning off the dependency of miners.
Yeah.
It's kind of stupid, because the like Ethereum is built on the miners. Our security is coming from the miners. Obviously, we need to reward them. But at the same time, you kind of don't want to like go from having massively profitable mining industry to zero in one day.
But what you just said before, if the reward per second right now is actually potentially higher, then how is this in any way weaning them off?
Because it's lower than it was a year ago. And so that's what many of them are arguing, that, you know, when we bought our mining equipment a year and a half ago, the promise was that we would get 5 ETH per block, and they made all their profitability calculations based on that. Now you're changing the game, and we are, you know, barely profitable anymore.
And what will probably happen is that there will be an Ethereum, I guess, whatever you call pre-metropolis, the Ethereum village, which would be like whatever miners go off and they'll continue doing their own thing, or they'll just mine Monero and switch onto the drugs trade. Yeah,
miners will follow the profits, and so they'll mine something else that's more profitable. And I don't think it's a problem, honestly. That I even think like cutting off completely from full reward to nothing is a problem, because they have other things to do with their hardware. It's not, and the argument that we should be like reducing miners because they won't be there, like what are we trying to gain? Are we trying to protect people and their investments from themselves, or like I'm not sure, like I haven't fully understood that argument of weaning off like the miner community.
On that topic, because we kind of just very quickly touched on it before, but can we go a little bit more into the difficulty bomb or the Ice Age extension? Like what have they actually done to do this? Like what does that mean when they say, oh yeah, we're going to postpone this?
So basically, the mining of Ethereum, with each block, it becomes a little bit harder to make the next block. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, since it's a little bit harder, and it's basically it's a lottery, you're getting random chances at it. If it's more difficult to get each one, and it's less likely that you get each one, then it takes a little bit longer each time. Mm-hmm. And so...
But how would they postpone that exactly?
Right. So the way you postpone that is you then reduce the difficulty again by like a chunk, which is exactly what they've done. They reduce the difficulty, which is why the block times have gone down so low. And now you can pay with beer with Ethereum again.
So it's really a dramatic shift.
Definitely a dramatic shift. So you see these things on Reddit of like, oh my god, block times went down to 13 seconds or whatever, and confirmation times or whatever.
And then over time, though, again, this will become longer and longer.
Get back to this point again at some point in the future. But hopefully, putting my optimistic hat on, we will have the proof of stake by then.
But this means they could do this at any time as well. They could just do this again.
Yeah.
Be like, oh, actually.
Yeah.
But so the the original thought here, and this is actually, it's pretty important to say that this is different from like normal, quote unquote, difficulty increase. So Bitcoin has difficulty increase, but that is as a result of more miners joining the network. So because there is more hash power, it increases difficulty. This is an artificial difficulty increase. Even if there are no more miners, difficulty will increase because it's built into the code that, you know, we were increasing difficulty as a function of time.
And actually, Bitcoin has that as well. It's just not as fast acting as
I didn't realize.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, they add one zero to the hash to the length of zeros that you got to find. So,
the reason they put this in is purely as an incentive mechanism to switch to proof of stake. That's the only point. Like they wanted to say, unless we switch to proof of stake, this network will be worthless. And it's just that they also conveniently have a way to postpone it indefinitely.
I know that in this hard fork, there had been there were certain other features that were supposed to be included. We just kind of discovered this.
One of these was proof of stake.
And so really, was proof of stake supposed to be in the Byzantium?
Byzantium and Constantinople are the split up version of the metropolis, which was supposed to be a single update. That was supposed to be the proof of stake one. It's supposed to have all these other things going on. These things have been put into the easy bit and the hard bit, basically. This past Monday was the easy bit. Although saying that, like, there were certainly a lot of problems with it. Like, the fact that both Ethereum and Geth had major problems days before the hard fork happened. I don't know if CPP Ethereum had that, but you know, C++ is known for its reliability, so I assume that they were perfect. And like the fact that we haven't had any major problems since then is a real, it's very encouraging, and it's very we're very lucky, but we were certainly cutting it very close. And you see things like there are improvement proposals that were accepted like 2 months before the hard fork was going to happen, and they didn't have a concrete spec. They only had like the proposal and some ideas. And like even though this was quote unquote the easy bit, this was still like there was a lot of work put into this, and it was still cutting it fine as far as like whether or not it was going to go well.
And there was a lot of feedback from people saying that this was somehow mismanaged or poorly communicated. Why is that? Is that too political?
I think it was that everyone was pushed for time to try and prevent the network from becoming worthless as a result of this difficulty bomb. And so corners were cut. And luckily, we still had quite a recognizable square, if I'm going to continue that metaphor. But there were still sacrifices were made in the name of pragmatism.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to know exactly what goes into, like you said, the management. It's hard to quote any particular mismanagement. But certainly, so the idea was we pushed to the test network, and the notice to push to the test network was rather short. I'm not in the dev calls, so I don't know how short it actually was, but I know that Parity pushed it out pretty short time before it was supposed to happen on the test network. And then the idea was once it's run reliably without issue on the test network for a certain number of weeks, it should be good to go in production and be pushed and etc. The problem is that there's no incentive whatsoever to try to break anything on the test network, right? Like it's not worth anything. You can't steal anything. You can't short the testnet tokens and try to disrupt the network and profit off of it. So there's no incentive to try to break it, and therefore no issues were found. But then when the Ethereum Foundation, I think it, all the work is sponsored by the Ethereum Foundation, but I wouldn't swear on it, with fuzz testing, they actually found several issues with Parity, found issues with Geth and several other clients. And these are hugely valuable tests, and like we should have had that a lot sooner. We should have made sure that all of those tests are running successfully before we even commit to a date of when we should push out the actual live update. Unfortunately, now like the tests were running, they were finding issues, and everyone was having to patch their clients like days before the thing was going live. So that was sort of unfortunate, but hopefully we'll learn from it and be sure to like employ all of these new testing techniques that we have in our arsenal now, and do that long before the next one.
And this is the thing, like this is still a problem of our own creation. This is like the Ethereum community decided that they wanted to have this difficulty bomb, and really it was the difficulty bomb that caused all of these corners to be cut. But like, as has been shown here, we can still cheat in our Weight Watchers diary. We can still just postpone this inevitably if we want to. And if we realize that these things are causing more problems than they're going to solve, we can always just disable the difficulty bomb entirely and keep miners going indefinitely. But obviously that has long-term consequences that maybe we don't want to deal with as well. And this is the thing. Everything's a trade-off. We can complain about like the deployment of this. And I do love complaining, so I am going to continue doing it. But we have to accept that everything is going to be a trade-off, where there's some benefits to the approach that was taken and there are some downsides. And the benefits was that we got the transaction time down again, and the downsides were that maybe the whole network's going to go down in the next 2 weeks because someone finds a DOS. Yeah, it's all pluses and minuses.
Looking forward, we don't have any information really on the second part of it yet, do we?
Not other than, so I mean, the idea is to deploy this hybrid proof of stake scheme, and the details of which are still unclear. But we were talking a little bit about proof of stake earlier, and I think it's important to clarify that this next update will not move Ethereum to proof of stake. I mean, it will move it to this hybrid model. There will still be miners, there will still be proof of work done. The proof of stake bits is sort of to start creating checkpoints and start building up the architecture so that we, in some other third future hard fork, we can actually move to full proof of stake.
Was Metropolis ever proposed as the movement towards full proof of stake, or was it always movement towards hybrid?
My understanding, it was always proposed to be hybrid, yeah.
Okay. Do they have a name for the next one that is full proof of stake?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't know. I don't have a funny name for it either, I'm afraid. And like, there's a reason this proof of stake keeps being postponed. There are no production-ready implementations of proof of stake in existence right now. Not really. I mean, there are ones that exist in some university laboratory somewhere. But there is nothing. There are no major blockchains that use proof of stake because the technology is about as old now as proof of work was when Bitcoin first came out.
But doesn't like BitShares and Steemit actually use it fully?
Are they big enough for this to be
okay?
Like Ethereum is the second biggest blockchain in the world as far as monetary value, which is the only value that matters.
I'd certainly say that. Steemit and BitShares and whatever is certainly a big enough test base to say that delegated proof of stake exists and works. It's just that the type of proof of stake that Ethereum is going after is the one that is still kind of in a research phase, and it's not really settled exactly how it should work or whether or not it does work to a certain extent. So it's proof of stake is much like proof of work, a very broad term. The devil is in the details, and some models of proof of stake exist and work, but they're not the types of, like, it's not the model that Ethereum is going after. So
yeah, right.
Well, on that note, do we want to say some concluding thoughts?
Sure. Concluding thoughts. Everything seems to be good so far. The fork went about as smoothly as you'd expect, given the circumstances. No miners have taken their toys and gone home. They're everyone's on the new version.
There's been no revolt.
There has been no popularist uprising, no. There has been no Ethereum French Revolution.
I know that the people who were very, very stressed last week seem less stressed, which is good.
Sure, yeah.
I think that goes for the whole community. You could, like, leading up to a hard fork is always kind of nerve-wracking for everyone involved, whether you're, you know nothing about it, and you hear the term hard fork, like I said before, it's kind of stress-inducing in itself. Or whether you're a developer working on this, trying to push out updates. I think and everyone in between, it's always kind of stressful. And it's good that it's live, and hopefully no one finds any issues.
Cool.
And hopefully if they are found, they're patched before they're actually exploited.
Yeah.
And right. Looking forward to the future where we get some more proof of stake stuff. I'm always a big proof of stake nerd. I'm always an advocate for getting out there and preventing the inevitable heating of the planet.
Hmm.
Yep.
So,
how do you guys feel? Maybe on a future podcast, we could actually go really quite a bit deeper into proof of stake and actually look at a lot of the different proposals.
Yeah. Sure, would be cool. I mean, I know Polkadot's implementation very well. I don't know Casper very well, and I don't know the delegated stuff that well. So it'd be really good as an excuse to actually find out what the alternatives might be.
Nice. And anyone listening, if you have some ideas for future podcast topics, please just let us know. We are very interested to hear what you think.
Absolutely. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.